You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, November 3rd, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Victoria Bassetti, senior advisor of States United Action, author of Electoral Dysfunction, a Survival Manual for American Voters. We'll be talking about the election deniers on the ballot in your state, plus the state legislature efforts to overturn elections in the future, potentially. The Fed will raise interest rates yet again after already raising it six times this year. That sounds dangerous. We will bear the brunt of this in the coming months, but dozens of lawyers who work to overturn the 2020 election have new jobs on Republican campaigns across the country. Remember the names John Eastman and others? Coup Redux. And also Redistributed. And in Michigan, Republican election deniers are reportedly recruiting operatives to be poll workers by the thousands. In better news, a Monmouth poll indicates that the debate between Fetterman and Oz had little impact. However, on key issues, the numbers between the two candidates have still narrowed. In Wisconsin, both the Senate and governor's race appear to be toss-ups, while Bud in North Carolina has maintained at least a five-point lead. In Brazil, after nearly two decades of silence, Bolsonaro has apparently privately accepted defeat.
Slinked off.
But he did not do so in front of the cameras for his supporters. Trump playbook to the T.
He begged them to stop the trucker blockades as well. He's honestly more responsible than Trump.
That is really saying something. In Israel, election results show Netanyahu's extremist far-right coalition has a likely insurmountable lead. Bibi's back, baby! Back with a vengeance on Palestinians. Former Prime Minister of Pakistan Imran Khan has been shot in the leg at a rally in what his team is calling an assassination attempt. He should recover, thankfully. A new report from the Brennan Center for Justice indicates that the U.S. fought more than a dozen secret wars in the last two decades, the extent of which we may never know. But Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, our operations there and our death toll, it's just, there's no sunlight on that. And lastly, new witness testimony claims that the head of the Oath Keepers tried to contact Trump a few days after January 6th, imploring him to use military force to remain in power. In case we need a reminder of who the Oath Keepers are, and the Boogaloo Boys, and those other paramilitary cosplayers who are backing up Trump. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is an M Majority Report Thursday. I am back. I'm back with a vengeance like Netanyahu, but this time I'm just here to not murder people, but murder the show. Damn. All right. That's not something to make light of. That is going to be, you know, something that we'll be talking about in the coming weeks, the results and the fallout from the Israeli election. But
He's a cockroach.
It's hard. Well, I mean, it's like, it's not him, though. It, like, what's the differentiation between Nothing. These parties? And, like,
well,
you see
and, like, Lapid,
the,
yeah.
the Kahanist yeah. folks, yeah. who are basically just genocidal exterminationists.
And they were, there's a lot of hay being made about the extremist coalition and members that Netanyahu was appealing to, but this literally just happened last time. So, same folks, same essentially, supremacists that are being appealed to in Israel. We will
Fascism.
Have yeah right we will have a guest on to talk about that as well, but before we get to our interview with Victoria, and we pre-taped this interview, and I encourage everybody to check it out, especially if you're in one of the states where you know that you have an election denier on the ballot. But even if you don't know, you probably do, because the numbers on that, I think around 40 states in the country, so that's 80%, there's an election denier on the ballot for either governor, secretary of state, or attorney general. So just be aware of that and check out this interview if you can. But Biden spoke to this real concern last night, actually, at Union Station in Washington, D.C. He did not use the based lighting that he had previously that had the right wing calling him a Nazi, just because of aesthetics. I thought it was like Dark Brandon personified. Was that the origin of Dark Brandon?
No.
Oh, okay.
Dark Brandon was before that.
But that was Dark Brandon Rising.
Yeah. Yes. People, Ryan Cooper included, I think we had him on the show around the time, spoke to some people, I think, around the White House who thought that Biden officials were actually, like, cognizant of the meme and, like, embracing it.
Yes.
And that was how it manifested in that speech. But I guess they've shied away from
they've
that.
They've shied, right. They felt they round. Had their moment in the sun, but I mean, lean
Big
into
mistake.
It.
No one's gonna, no one cares about the speech besides, you know, like, Rich Lowry of the National Review.
Yeah. But at the same time, he said a lot of good things in this speech. In my opinion, it's too little too late, emphasizing the threat of Republicans and on democracy. So here he is talking about how this election cycle is not just about inflation or crime, the things that Republicans are focusing on, or the things that Democrats are focusing on, like abortion. It's about something more existential than that as well, and that's the democratic process in this country itself.
We must, with one overwhelming, unified voice, speak as a country and say there's no place for voter intimidation or political violence in America, whether it's directed at Democrats or Republicans. No place, period. No place ever. I speak today near Capitol Hill, near the U.S. Capitol, the citadel of our democracy. I know there's a lot at stake in these midterm elections, from our economy, the safety of our streets, to our personal freedoms, the future of health care, Social Security, Medicare. It's all important. But we'll have our differences. We'll have our difference of opinion. And that's what it's supposed to be. But there's something else at stake. Democracy itself. I'm not the only one who sees it. Recent polls have shown that an overwhelming majority of Americans believe our democracy is at risk, that our democracy is under threat. They too see that democracy is on the ballot this year, and they're deeply concerned about it. So today, I appeal to all Americans, regardless of party, to meet this moment of national and generational importance. We must vote, knowing what's at stake, and not just the policy of the moment, but institutions that have held us together as we sought a more perfect union are also at stake. We must vote knowing who we have been, what we're at risk of becoming.
All right. Well, reading it in text was a little more inspiring than hearing it. I'll say that.
I think this clip really lays bare the limitations of having a guy whose sensibilities are like Joe Biden's.
An institutionalist?
Yeah.
Because he just talked about our institutions. People vote on institutions. Don't you know, Bradley?
Of course. And norms and the mores. Yeah. Also, with that being said, too, it's also this idea of basically saying, this should be, you know, a maxim regardless of party. But the point is, it's not.
Yes.
The actual point is, it is not a maxim of all voters and of all elected officials and candidates.
That's the thing, why do regardless of party? It's the Republicans that are anti-democracy.
Right.
That is what the reality is.
We've made this point many times on the show before, but this is the fundamental weakness of trying to make this argument while you have someone like Nancy Pelosi, like the Speaker of the House of Representatives, saying, we need a strong Republican Party. What a strong Republican Party looks like is Carrie Lake being the governor of Arizona. Strong Republican Party looks like is having someone like Christina Caramo in Michigan becoming Secretary of State and literally in 2024 refusing to certify the votes in Michigan. That's what a strong Republican Party will lead to. So this is the failure of this messaging, especially when it comes 5 days before we're supposed to vote.
Yeah, and if this party was serious about actually maintaining power, they would have coordinated their efforts with the January 6th committee when making this message, as opposed to, like, as you say, 5-6 days out, scrambling to say, well, we should remind people that, you know, the Republican Party is anti-democratic.
Maybe
and
votes
doesn't
of the
care
Constitution
about the rule of
matters.
Well, he's doing this in part because of the attack, right, on Pelosi?
I think so. But at the same time, you know, then don't make the case that it's regardless of party, we should be voting in a way that upholds democracy. Because the way that Republican voters feel is that, or I mean, they if you actually gave them truth serum, maybe they wouldn't say that this is the case. But they motivate themselves by saying, well, the Democrats are stealing the election and they're anti-democratic. So that's not motivating.
And with regards to the question of democracy, it's true that one party is better on democracy. The Republican Party wants to attack democracy. Democrats want to maintain democracy. But the problem is, if you just maintain it, it's like a car. It breaks down. Democracy is something that you actively need to build. So it would be things like not taking no from the effing parliamentarian for an answer on legislation and things like that, because that stuff is literally the brakes on democracy.
So is the filibuster.
Exactly, the filibuster too. And so, like, these sorts of things, if you can't make a credible pitch and then hide behind these institutional anti-democracy sort of, like, MacGuffins.
And Matt, you've made this point before with, like, what happened. And listen, this is not, as we always say with this stuff, we have to talk about accountability measures in ways that are available to us, regardless of our opinion on, like, the carceral state. But, like, Jeanine Añez in Bolivia, Matt's made this point before. She was charged and imprisoned for the coup she tried to mount on Evo Morales. Like, there was actual accountability for subverting democracy in that country. That doesn't exist here.
No.
There's no accountability.
Well, that would be divisive.
Right.
I mean, yeah. So, like, I understand that giving a speech about the attack on Paul Pelosi, that should have been the case. But this should have been a part of the messaging in the lead-up. Yeah. And, you know, you can't... I think they really did not time the findings of the January 6th committee well, because, one, the last kind of piece of bombshell footage that they released was footage taken by Nancy Pelosi's daughter of her behind the scenes when she knew she was being filmed, kind of, you know, being a bit afraid. But there was no real kind of ramp up or stakes that were associated with it, as opposed to what they released over the summer, which was the second-by-second timeline footage of how people were descending on the Capitol and how Trump was sparking it with his tweets and with his agitation, and the footage from body cams and seeing the mayhem and the cries of pain from the Capitol Police. Like, that would have been a hammer message. And at the same time, reminding the voters that this is the party that you would be supporting. that would have been a way to actually coordinate your political message. But instead, Democrats feel that it's beneath them to do such a thing because that would be politicizing the process. Newsflash, the process of politics is politicized because there's a part, and when you're talking about threats to democracy, it's inherently political because that one side wants to overturn democracy. So I think coordinating your messaging as a president and as a committee that's investigating the former president and his efforts to overturn the election, that's pretty small ball in compared to the stakes that we're talking about here. So I just wish that there was like less rear CYA happening right now. Like, cover your ass on inflation. Now they're suddenly blaming corporate price gouging. They should have been doing that all along. Cover your ass on the election. Now we're going to talk about the Republican threats to democracy, barely saying Republican at all in the way that you're framing it. Like,
but it's like people like to talk about the like incompetence, but it's like, why were we so late to blame price gouging? It's because of the donor class. Like, yeah. It's because these parties, like, I think staffers would be ready to. I mean, Warren Gunnels, for instance, was always Bernie's guy, was always saying that. But there's a resistance to messaging that way because, like, it's uncouth. it's from below, and that's not the orientation of the political leadership of the Democratic Party.
And they also have a game plan that is, it hasn't been updated in 30 years, and it all involves running the ball and playing conservatively on offense and then playing prevent defense. And that's what they did the entire time with abortion.
And saying mega, 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 ultra, ultra, mega, uber, mega.
Well, don't worry. But first, they poll tested it with consultants for 2 years.
You know, Rich Lowry is sort of, he did get the opposite message from the speech. He says, so Biden is not going to mention that Paul Pelosi attacker was seriously mentally ill and instead connect his heinous act to January 6th. How tawdry and dishonest, although not unexpected. And I'll just say, you think none of the Gen 6 people had mental illness, right? Like, the thing about that was the coincidence of Republican propaganda, agitation ahead of an election, and the mental illness that is untreated because we underinvest in people's mental health in this country, in part because of Republican Party doesn't want to do anything about that. So, like, that's a very false distinction to make.
Yeah. All right. We are going to take a quick break, but first, we have a message from one of our sponsors.
I think this is a troll now at this point.
Well, we have a complicated relationship, myself and Hello Tushy, but it's really just a positive one. But they do like to troll me a little bit, I think. Isn't it crazy that in 2022 we have high-speed internet, celebrities going into space, and electric cars, and yet people are still cleaning their bums the way our Victorian brothers and sisters did with toilet paper? Step into the 21st century and upgrade your bathroom routine and start washing your bum with Hello Toshiba Days, because smearing your business around with toilet paper is so 100 years ago. It's just like, yeah, come on, upgrade. The Hello Tushy bidet attachment washes your bum with fresh water for a way better clean than toilet paper. Simply spray and pat dry. It attaches to your existing toilet. No electrician or plumber needed. It installs in less than 8 minutes. Cuts down on your TP use by 80%, saves money and paper waste. It's an investment in yourself. It's an investment in your bank account improving over time. And it's really easy to install. Hello Tushy has cleaned over 1 million happy bums. I want all of our listeners to have clean bums. This is my driving force in this profession. Visit hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping right now. That's hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. And tag at Hello Tushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean bum with you. That is HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Victoria Bassetti. We We are back, and we are joined now by Victoria Bassetti, Senior Advisor of States United Action, author of Electoral Dysfunction, which is amazing, a survival manual for American voters. Victoria, thanks so much for taking the time to come on today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, it's necessary here because the midterms are less than a week away. My anxiety levels about it continue to climb. And your guys' project at States United Action has two really useful tools that people can use if they want to see there are election deniers on their ballot, plus also what's happening with their state legislatures and their attempts to overturn democracy as well. But let's start with the replacing the refs tracker, the election deniers on the ballot here. How did you guys decide on making this a priority, and when did you realize that there were going to be so many election deniers on the ballot this midterm cycle that you needed a tracker to just, like, at the very least, inform people?
We need multiple Excel spreadsheets to keep track of this. You know, it all actually started more than a year ago when in 2021, we were hearing all sorts of reports that, and what we were hearing, two things. The first is we were hearing clear efforts by, leading politicians and personalities, if you will, in the election denying community, calling on people to run for offices. And then we were hearing people saying, kind of on the ground, local, people in the democracy community saying that they were seeing people running for these posts. And, in some cases, it was like county commissioners or, election judges. So we just kind of started with a really small experiment in Pennsylvania. We pulled up the names of a bunch of people who were running for offices in a few counties, and all of a sudden started finding people who were kind of election deniers running for these offices. We found one person who had chartered multiple buses to January 6th in Washington, D.C. So after that little snapshot that we did, we decided, we really need to step back and take a look at this systematically and nationwide. And so we began a project involving multiple researchers and people who started looking systematically at all of the people who were running for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state throughout the country. And we've been doing that systematically since the beginning of this year. We started with the primaries, and now we're ready for the general this Tuesday. And what we're showing is that there's an election denier running for one of those big three offices in more than 50% of the races in the United States. More than half of Americans are going to be, covered or are in the middle of selecting whether or not an election denier is going to be in charge of their election results in 2024.
I mean, that is a scary statistic. As you guys lay out, 40 states plus DC have those have races that are going to have an election denier. So chances are, if you're living in the United States, that is that's going to be on your ballot. What are some of the states that are most concerning to you? I mean, Arizona really sticks out to me because all three, Carrie Lake running for governor, the AG, and the Secretary of State candidate, all election deniers.
Yeah, so if you take a look at what were the states that were the closest and kind of, on the knife's edge in 2020, and then you map that against 2024, what you would be looking at are Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. So those are the states that, people might want to pay the most attention to, but it doesn't just matter if you were kind of on one of those knife edge states in 2020. It also matters if you're in New York or if you're in Ohio. Wherever you are, you ought to care about this because it really matters for every race along the way. If you're really concerned about the presidential in 2024, those states I named are the ones that you might want to be paying the most attention to. But like I said, it doesn't matter where you are. It matters because you know, kind of selecting an election denier to run your elections is going to have an impact up and down the ballot.
And those states, though, are unique in the sense that you might expect there to be all election deniers running in, say, Arkansas. But I was taking a look at your tracker, and it's like, okay, none, right? I mean, it seems...
Or Georgia, right?
Well, that's an almost unique situation because their integrity was called into question by Trump. And so the only thing that prevented them from being election deniers, frankly, was their own kind of egos, saving us for the first time in a while, Republican egos. But
I think, you know, I think it's maybe a little bit more than that. We probably ought to give them a little bit more credit than that. They showed some real integrity then in 2020.
Yeah. All right. But I'm loath to give Republicans credit, but for your purposes, I hear what you're saying. What is scary to me is what happens when states that are, as you say, a little bit more in play and could go either way, if there is a resurgence, or not resurgence, but a high turnout of Republicans and people who are motivated MAGA fans, essentially, then that could have so many impacts on the way that those state elections and even federal elections are constructed based on their influence, that we could be seeing a very rapid transition to a deeper red as opposed to like purple states, let alone just the threats of democracy.
Yeah, without necessarily having to put, you know, kind of a partisan valence on this, although it's pretty clear that there is a, you know, one party that does seem to kind of go this way a little bit more than another. You know, what matters is that we're potentially setting up states where the will of the voters isn't actually respected, or, you know, that's the worst case scenario, or a situation where there's chaos and uncertainty and constant doubt about whether or not our democratic system is working. And when you sow that continual level of distrust and doubt, you have democratic systems begin to break apart. You know, trust and confidence in the way we run our elections is the lifeblood of our democracy. And when you break that apart, you see conflict, you see violence, you see an inability to reach resolution, you see very bad substantive policy outcomes as a result of it. It's frightening to live in a society where you've got election deniers in charge and where they are, you know, kind of systematically undermining the way we run our government, which is the way we try to get along without fighting.
Right. It is also another interesting dynamic that you do see that there. Lee Zeldin, for example, is an election denier in New York, which is where I live. And he's been riding this kind of tough on crime narrative ahead of the election. And that seems to actually be buoying him in a much closer race than I think a lot of people anticipated versus Kathy Hochul for governor. Can you talk about that race in particular and the dynamics of his election denial in a state like New York, which is very anti-Trump for the most part, but anything can happen, especially in a midterm election when there's, you know, a Democratic president.
Yeah. So, it's sometimes hard to figure out whether or not an election denier is an election denier because they really believe it or because they need to say it in order to rally the troops and to kind of really get a core base to show up and vote out of anger and fear. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that in a bunch of these races, and you might consider New York to be one of them, you've got a candidate who's really tapping into that, you know, kind of really super, you know, tribal fear-based voting, you know, allegiance to Trump. And New York does have voters who are you know, kind of really, you know, kind of into Trump. You may not think that based on New York City, but, you know, even I think Staten Island went for Trump.
Yeah, I've driven through Long Island recently. There are a lot of Trump flags around there.
Right. So kind of, you know, signaling allegiance to that by being an election denier is an incredibly important thing that's being done. And so I think that, you know, I think that's to a certain degree what's going on in that case. Also, you know, like I'll put it out there. This is the first time New York has had a woman running for governor. So I wouldn't, you know, put it past, you know, that's kind of a little bit of a factor in the tightening of the race.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I would guess 100% true. Also the fact that she has not yet been elected herself, which I think creates a complex stew of dynamics in that race. Can you talk a bit about the Kansas governor's race? Because Kansas was kind of in the spotlight, given the fact that it was via a ballot initiative, it protected abortion rights, which was a welcome surprise in the wake of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But there's an election denier on the ballot there.
Yeah, so Kansas, I think, as you know, is an incredibly interesting state. And, you know, there's that really famous book, you know, What's the Matter with Kansas? Is that the name of the book I'm spacing on?
I do not know. I'm sorry.
So there's a really famous book on Kansas about the way it votes. I think it's by Thomas Frank.
Matt says, yes, you were right about the title. So there you
go. And you know, Kansas has a long and incredible tradition of progressive politics that, you know, kind of arose out of the progressive movement and the kind of progressive farmers in the 1930s. So Kansas is contrary to most people's kind of instinctive belief, a little bit more of a you know, purple state than you might think, although it's gone awfully red in the last, you know, 20 years or so. But, you know, they do have a Democratic governor right now, and they've elected Democratic senators in the past. It's maybe a little bit too much Kansas history than you want, but I actually happen to be really fascinated by Kansas, and I've visited
it. It's fascinating.
A few times and really liked it. So what's happening in Kansas is you've got a baseline of a kind of a progressive base that's always been and has continued to be present in Kansas that's been in kind of relatively sharp decline over the course of the last 25 years. But the Dobbs decision really kind of just snapped things in that state in a way that was shocking. And you saw a massive surge of young women surging into the electorate, registering and voting right before that referendum in the summer. And so the question that we're going to be seeing in this election is whether or the question, an answer to the question that we're going to be seeing in this election is whether or not the Dobbs decision has hyper-motivated the electorate or whether or not it's actually also changed the electorate. Because in the wake of Dobbs, not just in Kansas, but in a bunch of other states, we've seen a surge of young women registering to vote more.
Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, those are the indicators as well. Yeah,
absolutely. And that is one of the things that makes predicting the outcome of this election very difficult at this stage of the game, because most pollsters model their turnout decisions and their understanding of what an electorate is based upon past practice. And the real question that we're facing in this election is whether or not Dobbs has really significantly changed both turnout and the electorate itself, and whether or not the pollsters are modeling that properly. So, you know, trying to decide what's going on based on the polls right now is a little bit of a dicey proposition.
That is one of the most optimistic things I've heard in recent weeks.
I'm a total optimist.
Well, and it's welcome because that is, absolutely true. And we saw that with why some of the polls were wrong along the margins when MAGA candidates were running, for example, because they didn't take that into account. But hopefully it breaks the other way this time because those numbers are real, as you say. The influx of female voters who were registering in those states, and it was massive in Kansas. I'm just hoping it carries over to the midterms. Let's touch on Michigan as well, because there are five election deniers running for those positions, and some of them, you know, their independents don't have a likelihood of winning, but at the very least there are three Republican election deniers, and I should not say independents, but different parties, but three Republican independents who are election deniers on the ballot. You have the governor, gubernatorial candidate Tudor Dixon, and then AG and Secretary of State as well. What is some of, in your work, what you've discovered in looking at Michigan in particular?
So people, I'm sure, are familiar with the fact that in 2020, I think it's in the early summer or the late spring of 2020, there were a number of people who were arrested because they had plotted to kidnap and kill the governor of Michigan. And it was driven in part by kind of COVID concerns, but it was also driven by, you know, kind of flat out anti-democratic norms. So in Michigan, it is a complicated state right now. You've got three people, women, running on the Democratic side of the ticket for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, who were incredibly strong in the 2020 election in terms of certifying their votes for Joe Biden that year. And Michigan, incidentally, on a vote basis, was pretty much a blowout, effectively, for Joe Biden. I think he won by more than 80,000 votes, which is a pretty substantial margin in that state. Nevertheless, the election denier community has been really strong in that state and has been, you know, kind of very active. Indeed, one of the candidates for the candidate for attorney general in Michigan has been referred for criminal prosecution because there's evidence that he may or may not. It's still obviously TBD. It's just an investigation, but there's evidence that he may have been a significant player in efforts to illegally crack open election machines in that state and improperly analyze them. And so it's sort of, you know, pretty wild. He's like a super election denier. He's not a denier. He's also an election denier actor. And so he's one of the guys who's running. I think all of the polls at this stage of the game do indicate that the three non-election denier candidates, Gretchen Whitmer for governor, Dana Nessel for attorney general, and Jocelyn Benson for secretary of state are ahead in all of their races. But the election denier gene is strong in Michigan.
Right. And it's just something to kind of keep your eye on because they have many lives, of the anti-democratic candidates.
Yeah, you know, Jocelyn Benson, who's the current Secretary of State and the candidate for Secretary of State in Michigan, I think speaking about election deniers recently said something to the effect of voting for an election denier is like putting an arsonist in charge of the fire department. And I think she put it quite well.
Yeah, that is well said. Anything else that you feel is really notable for people to know in terms of like the gubernatorial, secretary of state, and attorney general candidates around the country? Because I do want to talk about state legislatures as well.
I think as you can see that one of the most interesting things is that election denial has been a centerpiece of many of these people's candidacies. It's not just something that they kind of say and then move on from. It's something that many of these candidates are are persistent about and they talk about a lot, that tells you that this is something to be, I think, genuinely worried about. These are not people who are just ticking off a box.
Yeah. And lastly, on this topic, you mentioned at the start of our conversation that, you know, it's not just county commissioners, it's people running on the ballot for Secretary of State, Governor, Attorney General. But what I'm also concerned about, and I'm wondering if you've heard any reports about this, efforts to recruit election deniers for polling booth jobs. That is going to be so, I mean, like, as poll workers, do you think that they're going to try to kind of infiltrate that part of the electoral process?
Right. So I think it is very clear that there is what Steve Bannon called a precinct by precinct strategy that they're employing, and that does involve having either observers or poll watchers in precincts, or actual poll workers in the precincts. I think vis-a-vis the poll workers, while it's certainly not ideal to have those sort of people as officials at your precinct, it's important for every voter to know that there's never any one poll worker who can make a final decision that will significantly impact your ability to vote. So people should go into their precincts 100% confident that their vote is going to be counted and that there are multiple fail-safe mechanisms to make sure that their vote is counted. That being said, if any voter does go into a polling place and encounters either an observer or a poll worker who they think is behaving inappropriately or behaving in a partisan manner, they should call the election hotline, which is 1-866-OUR-VOTE. It's 1-866-OUR-VOTE. You should immediately report any incident about that. And that hotline, which runs nationwide, will immediately flag and run the incident up to all of the appropriate people so that that problem can be taken care of. So as worrying as what you described is, I think it's really important for every voter to feel confident, and they should feel confident, that their vote will be counted and that there are multiple fail-safe systems for taking care of anyone who tries to misbehave at a polling place.
Good to know. Yes. And you have that hotline, people, if you need to report something. So let's now talk about these state legislatures and what is being proposed on that level. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case called Moore v. Harper, which is one of the most concerning cases, in my opinion, that they could rule on. And it could completely change the way that elections go, because it basically allows for state legislatures to have a lot more say in how those elections are structured. Can you talk about the threat of that case and just what the ramifications could be?
Yeah, so I'm actually pretty limited in what I can say about that case, and that's because my organization is representing one of the parties
in front of the
Supreme Court. So as much as I would like to be able to talk about it, I need to tell people that we're bound by an attorney-client relationship in terms of talking about it, and I would tell people just go read the papers, you know, in this that have been filed in the Supreme Court. I'm so sorry, I can't talk more about it.
No, that's fine. I apologize. I didn't realize that was the case. But and you can listen to our coverage on this as well, because we've been quite passionate and fearful about what any outcome could be on that front. But then let's just turn to some of these state legislatures and some of the bills that you're seeing being proposed and adopted on that level that could have deep ramifications for the electoral process.
Right. So this is the other thing that we saw. In as much as we've seen like a wave of people, election deniers, going into this space, we've also seen this kind of weird, negative, hostile creativity regarding the law flow into the space. And we've seen, you know, state legislatures initiate a tidal wave of new laws or prospective new laws that would rework and kind of introduce this level of hyperpartisanship and doubt into our election system. And that's highlighted in a report that we've done, which is called Democracy Crisis in the Making, where we've chronicled well over 200 bills that have been introduced just this year. Like, and also if you add in 2021, it's even more pieces of legislation that have been introduced across more than 30 states. And each of these bills kind of would create or lay the groundwork legally for essentially chaos in our election system that would allow partisan legislatures or partisan election officials to essentially disregard the will of the voters. They do this through a variety of techniques. Like I said, it's this weird kind of hostile, anti-negative creativity. They keep coming up with new ideas and new ways to do things. But people probably remember at the beginning of 2021 when Georgia passed legislation that, amongst other things, really significantly increased the ability of a board that is selected by the partisan state legislature to examine and kind of initiate hostile takeovers of boards of election that they don't like. And the county that immediately drew their gaze was Fulton County, which is the most Democratic and African-American county in all of Georgia. So people probably remember that, but not just Georgia, there are a bunch of other states where they've been doing these sort of things, everything from, now I should say, the number of bills that have passed has been, you know, kind of in lower numbers than the number of bills that have been introduced.
That's good. Silver lining.
Silver lining. What we're going to be monitoring really carefully is after this election, when a lot of state legislatures are going to be, you know, kind of elected, what we're going to be monitoring really carefully is whether or not there's a real change and whether or not they're going to have the kind of wind in their sails and begin enacting more and more pieces of legislation. But we've been seeing some things like bills that would require all ballots be hand counted, which is a like taking election administration back to the, you know, the horse and buggy era.
Right.
And it's like it would introduce inaccuracy, partisanship. It would just introduce so many problems into our system to go back to hand counting ballots. As kind of nostalgic as it sounds, it's really not a good idea.
Well, and you know, this is, it's so silly because this is a difference, it's completely different than electronic voting where you can maybe, you know, have some concerns. This is just electronic reading of paper ballots. And they're deliberately, I think, trying to obscure that fact.
Yeah. Just, I think you put your finger on it, and I think that's so important, is that it's not everywhere, but almost everywhere, all voting is conducted on a piece of paper, and that piece of paper is maintained. And then it's like scanned into an electronic tabulator. But then, and that's how the votes are counted. But if there's ever any sign of a problem, you go back to the paper and you recount it.
Right.
And almost every state, you know, they do like before they use the tabulators, they do what's known as logic and accuracy testing every single time to make sure that the machines are properly programmed. And then after the election, they do audits to make sure that the machines properly counted the votes. And then if there's a recount, you pull out all of the paper ballots and you check it out. And, you know, they're like, since we started using these electronic tabulators, billions and billions of votes have been counted and tabulated and tested and retested and audited all over the place. And the number of errors are so tiny.
Yeah.
So, you know, these machines are, they're good. And we check so much to make sure that they're good. And the hand counting is slow. And it is also very, very inaccurate. I think there have been some studies that have shown that that hand counted tabulations are off by anywhere from 1 to 2%. And given that a lot of races are less than 1% or less than 2%, you're looking at some real errors if we go back to hand counting.
Yeah, again, hey, I mean, we can, they were also complaining that the election results were taking too long and how scary that would be. I mean, hand counting ballots, give me a break. You can do that as a back measure, but as the initial process, it's ridiculous. So can you also talk a little bit about some of the efforts to restrict and encumber mail-in voting?
Yeah, so that has been one of the most persistent lanes of attack against our current voting system, and it's happened everywhere. It's been by legislation, and it's been by litigation. For example, Delaware just recently passed a piece of legislation that would, for the first time ever in the state's history, allow no excuse mail-in balloting. It was immediately challenged in court. They took it all the way up to the Delaware Supreme Court, and the Delaware Supreme Court actually struck down the law in Delaware. So no excuse mail-in balloting there. In Arizona, for the longest time, they had what's known as the permanent early voting list. And that was a process where a voter could say, you know what, I just want to always receive a mail-in ballot. I'm going to be a permanent kind of mail-in sort of ballot person. And the Arizona State Legislature passed legislation that got rid of the permanent early voting system. Then you've seen in Pennsylvania, which also in 2019 implemented, you know, no excuse mail-in voting systems. You've seen multiple lawsuits trying to strike it down, as well as multiple pieces of legislation attempting to get rid of mail-in voting. And it's because, you know, meanwhile, of course, you've got states like Utah and Washington that have been using almost all mail-in voting for decades without any fraud or without any sort of problems. So in a lot of states, you've seen really concerted efforts to get rid of or hobble mail-in voting. And then on top of just getting rid of it, you're seeing very concerted efforts to kind of micro-examine every single piece of mail-in voting for any kind of minor discrepancy or any failure to perfectly fill out every last little bit of the ballot. And then if there's even a minor or technical deficiency in the ballot, there's an effort to throw it out.
Signature verification is one of those methods.
Yeah, signature verification. Another one is, like, you know, sometimes people, like if you're supposed to fill in your address, sometimes people will just put in the zip code, you know, or they'll forget to put the state in or something like that. You know, there are all sorts of things that people do to kind of shorthand. I mean, I do it all the time. Like if I'm sending a letter, sometimes I just put in my zip code instead of the whole, you know, city or something like that. And so they're going after people on that sort of stuff. All of which is by way of saying that if any of your listeners are voting by absentee or mail-in ballot, to follow the directions perfectly.
And just your mic's hidden your shirt just a little bit.
Sorry.
I just wanted to, no, it's okay.
Yeah.
Can you talk more specifically? And when you say going after people, I was just reminded of what we saw in Florida, where this is a little bit of an aside, but I couldn't, you know, have an election expert on and not talk about the way that Ron DeSantis and his government has been targeting and kind of trying to almost intentionally trick people who have felonies in the past. And there's a very small sliver of people who after that measure was passed, I think it was a ballot initiative in Florida, that cannot vote, and they made it very vague to, I think, send a message to anybody who might be qualified under this new designation that you might not actually be sure about your status, so you could be put in handcuffs and then have to deal with this situation and being arrested if you do try to vote. I mean, what do you make of the display of force from Ron DeSantis in Florida?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. It's a display of force rather than a real, I think, honest effort to ensure integrity in our election system. From what I know, and of course, facts always emerge. So at least I'm speaking about the facts as I know them right now. The people who were arrested made genuine mistakes, and they weren't trying to cheat or defraud the system. They certainly weren't doing anything that's kind of at the level of what you and I might consider a crime, you know, that really significantly injures people. These were people who made good faith mistakes. And I think they've been hauled out in handcuffs to send a message to people. And I really hope they get good criminal defense attorneys.
Yeah. Lastly, are there any states in particular that we should be keeping our eyes on for some of these state legislature efforts? Like, which states are kind of red flashing light, no pun intended, for things that people should be paying attention to next week?
Well, as you noted, Arizona is one of those states that has been kind of at the epicenter of much of the election denier movement and at the epicenter of the kind of the legislative efforts to kind of alter the way we run our elections. So has Texas. And so far in a lot of states, we've seen some of the worst efforts get pushed back. And those states include places like, you know, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and even Louisiana. So I would be watching those states in the coming year to see what happens.
All right. Well, Victoria Bassetti, senior advisor of States United Action, author of Electoral Dysfunction, a Survival Manual for American Voters. Thanks so much for your time today. I know this is probably a very busy time for you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, too. And everyone go vote.
Yes, please. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
We are back, and thanks so much to Victoria Bassetti for making that work. I know she's really busy at this time of year, so we were able to pre-record that interview, and very helpful. Check out their website. Do we have the link for that? States United Democracy Center. If you are in one of those states, if you're in any state, you should just check out the Secretary of State races, the Attorney General races, governor races, as well as what's on in your state legislature. Just do that if you have the opportunity, and encourage your family and friends to do so. With that said, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program and head into the fun half. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Oh, yeah. We had a fun sort of celebration of Lula da Silva's victory in Brazil over Bolsonaro, and talked to a deep state Cuba about how he transitioned from being a Canadian to Ivy Leaguer to working in the deep state for the Department of Defense, and to being iced out of that maybe for political reasons, and now being a podcaster, and talked about civil service bureaucracies and like diplomatic bureaucracies, what a State Department and those sorts of things should be, and as opposed to just like protecting the interests of capital, and had Cuba also talk about what we can expect from Lula's administration given certain political and economic context. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We'll be talking to Bronwyn Mehta about COP27 in Egypt for patrons this weekend on Sunday.
Very nice. On ESVN today, youtube.com/ESVN, because our OT segments, which we do on Thursday, will now officially be on the ESVN channel. And it's not youtube.com/ESVN. It's youtube.com/ESVN show. I apologize. So check us out there. We honestly have a packed show today for an OT episode, because we have to talk about Dan Snyder exploring the sale of the team. Unbelievably so. We have to talk about Steve Nash getting fired, Ime Udoka being in the wings very conveniently. We also have to talk about the NFL trade deadline, who won, who lost, and more, and plus give our picks for this weekend, because Bradley went 3-0 again this weekend.
So what is that, 6-0?
Yeah, 6-0 in the past 2 weeks, if you can do the math. I have not done so, so he has taken a bit of a lead against me, but I'm coming back with a vengeance this week. YouTube.com/ESPN
Vengeance
show.
Is on the mind for Emma today.
Have I talked about that a lot?
Yeah, you've been really like, every time the opportunity for vengeance comes up, you're emphasizing it.
I did drink a lot of blood this morning, so I feel like that might be a part of it. But now we have our friends here, Binder and Brandon. Soon.
You know what it is.
Backstreet's back, all right. What's up, guys?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. What's happening over on Doomed and Scam Economy, Binder?
Yeah, sure. So over on Doomed on Tuesday, I had on Lance from the Surfs, and we basically walked everybody through all the various right-wing conspiracies about the attack on Nancy Pelosi and her husband. We also spoke about, it was the first episode since Elon Musk took the reins over at Twitter, so we talked about that too, and the obvious overlap between those two things, where Elon Musk shared insane conspiracy theories on Twitter about the Pelosi attacker.
So the free speech suppressor has arrived.
right. Elon Musk suppressed his own speech.
Matt Censorious Binder.
Right. I'm one of the elites.
Ask questions anymore.
I'm one of the elites who won't pay for his blue check because I'm angry that the masses will be able to spend $8 a month to get their own blue check.
Yeah, I'm a billionaire Silicon Valley guy here to tell you that I'm ending feudalism by making blue checks purchasable on the marketplace.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that was hilarious. He just started haggling for like the price with Stephen King, like we were just at a fish market. It was great. I thought we were running like a professional business.
Yeah, no, I mean, but it's all the same when you come down to it, right? But I did like that. I saw that thread. We can talk about actually this in the fun half. This is definitely fun half stuff. Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
We also had a more social media centric episode. We talked about Kanye. We talked about Alex Jones, people falling down these rabbit holes of sort of conservative right wing demagoguery, if you will. We talked about the sort of future of social media and if whether it has a future. So, you know, check it out on discourse.
Okay, do so.
We did not talk about Elon Musk, though. I guess that's a missed opportunity. I kind of just like found it funny. I didn't have much to say about it.
We can touch on it in the fun half, maybe within the context of this great recirculated Bo Burnham clip.
Oh, that's a good clip. Yeah.
Yeah, he's good.
I resist. Yeah, we'll talk about it in the clip.
Quick. You're too cool for Inside.
I wanted to not like Bo Burnham. And I think he's won me over.
Yeah, it's impossible. I resisted it as well, but Inside like it was super emotional for me, honestly. But we will talk about. But I cried everything, as people know. 6462.
I forgot to mention Scam Economy.
Sorry. Yeah.
No, don't worry about it. Had its biggest episode ever, most downloaded ever. In case you're wondering if crypto is dead. And it was the episode, my 2 hour episode with, Yasmin Gagne and Connie Lynn, two reporters at Fast Company who got to sit down with the, founders of Yuga Labs, the people behind the Bored Ape Yacht Club NFTs. People were really interested in it. Also, it was on, I released it at a different day. Maybe that had something to do with it too. So also this week's Scam Economy will also be going up Sunday night to see if I can recapture the magic.
All right. Well, make sure that happens for him. Outdo yourself.
Let's go,
Binder. All right. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Nightmare.
Bring back DJ Dennis.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennis.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.